From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, mystifying, officials and investigators are no closer to learning the fate of the 229 passengers on board the missing Malaysia Airlines flight.
They've extended the search to the other side of the Malaysian Peninsula because they really don't know where this plane might have vanished because the plane has just disappeared into thin air.
Find out why Republicans are trying to fast-track US gas exports. We're in Brazil, where Soccer World Cup tourists could be in for a financial penalty. And David Cramer, former Assistant Secretary of State, gives his verdict on the actions of President Putin.
Putin likes to say he's coming to the defense of ethnic Russians in Ukraine. Well, he doesn't give a damn about Russians inside his own country.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Malaysia says it is widening its search area for a passenger jet which disappeared 3 days ago. This comes after criticism from China and calls for Malaysian authorities to step up their efforts to find flight MH370. The plane went missing en route from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing with 239 people on board. Malaysian officials have also changed their guidance on the possible identities of two men traveling on the plane with stolen passports. Malaysia's civil aviation chief, Azharuddin Abdul Rahman, told a press conference both men went through full security checks.
They looked at the security part of it, and they have gone through the full protocol of the security. That means that they have gone through screening. The baggage has been screened. The cabin baggage has been screened. And to us, that complied fully the protocol of aviation security.
The White House has announced that Arseniy Yatsenyuk, the prime minister of Ukraine's interim government, will visit Washington and hold talks with President Obama on Wednesday. It says the trip will highlight strong U.S. support for the people of Ukraine, following the recent ousting of former President Viktor Yanukovych and Russia's military incursion into the Crimea region. Lorna Shattuck reports from the U.S. Capitol.
White House Press Secretary Jay Carney said that Mr. Yatsenyuk's visit will involve top-level meetings, including with Barack Obama. Heading the agenda for discussions is likely to be the search for a peaceful solution to Moscow's intervention in Crimea and U.S. economic support for the new government in Kiev. Mr. Carney said the president is looking forward to the meeting. Arseniy Yatsenyuk first announced his plans for the trip on Sunday at a government meeting in Kiev. The Obama administration's already imposed visa restrictions and asset freezes on Russian officials whom it says are involved in the recent military incursion, but it's facing some domestic criticism for failing to take a tougher line with Moscow.
U.S. intelligence officials are preparing to step up the electronic monitoring of some 5 million government employees with security clearances. The move is aimed at catching out rogue agents, leakers, and corrupt workers abusing their special access to secret government operations. Nina Maria Potts reports from Washington.
The continuous monitoring of government employees via a centralized computer system has been in the works for a decade, but U.S. intelligence officials see a greater and much more urgent need to put federal workers with security clearance under scrutiny since the revelations of U.S. whistleblower Edward Snowden blew the lid on Washington's secret surveillance programs. The U.S. administration is set to launch a review of the government's security clearance process this month, part of an overhaul of its electronic monitoring systems. But privacy advocates and government worker unions argue the internal surveillance will put employees' private lives and personal data at risk.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Former NSA contractor Edward Snowden made a rare appearance through web video at the South by Southwest Music and Technology Festival in Texas on Monday, calling for greater safeguards to be placed on government surveillance programs. Speaking to a largely sympathetic audience, including members of the American Civil Liberties Union, Snowden said that the U.S. government has massively violated the Constitution. He also affirmed that he has no regrets about leaking hundreds of thousands of confidential government documents.
I took an oath to support and defend the Constitution, and I saw that the Constitution was violated on massive scales. The interpretation of the Fourth Amendment had been changed.
And Mexican officials have announced that they have killed a major drug lord who was thought to have already been shot dead more than 3 years ago. In 2010, the Mexican government announced that the man had been killed in a shootout, but his body was never found. But when it was discovered that the kingpin was still leading the Knights Templar drug cartel, Mexico's armed forces set about tracking him down. From Washington, Andrea Arenas reports.
Known as El Más Loco, or the craziest one, Nazario Moreno was the founder of La Familia Drug Cartel, a violent gang which dominated the drug trade in the state of Michoacán. On Sunday, members of the Mexican forces found Moreno and shot him dead in a gunfight after he refused to turn himself in. Moreno's death is the second major success for current President Enrique Peña Nieto, who in late February led an operation which led to the arrest of the most wanted drug lord, Joaquin Guzmán, also known as El Chapo. But the news is an embarrassment for former President Felipe Calderón, who said armed forces took Nazario Moreno back in 2010.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Intensify the search. China's reaction to the disappearance of a Malaysia Airlines flight still missing since it dropped off the radar on its way to Beijing from Kuala Lumpur on Saturday. Relatives of the 229 passengers and crew on board have been told to prepare for the worst. Some 40 ships and 34 aircraft are combing both sides of the Malaysian Peninsula after reports the Boeing 777 may have attempted to turn from its course. The FBI have now joined the investigation into what Malaysian officials have described as a mystifying aviation event. Following the story in Beijing is China's bureau chief for the Washington Post, Simon Drainer, and he spoke to FSN Reports earlier.
Well, Kevin, your guess is as good as mine, almost. I mean, the authorities have given another press conference in Kuala Lumpur where they basically admitted they don't know anything at all. Every lead that they've come up against seems to have vanished. They found a couple of oil slicks. They tested them. It wasn't jet fuel. They saw various bits of flotsam floating in the water. It looked like a door, but that disappeared. They couldn't find it again. There was a bit that looked like a life jacket, but that turned out to be something else, just a piece of floating debris, nothing to do with the plane. They've extended the search to the other side of the Malaysian Peninsula, because they really don't know where this plane might have vanished. So, you know, that just shows you they really are floundering around a bit, or seem to be anyway, because the plane has just disappeared into thin air.
Does the fact that they are now searching across the peninsula give some weight to the theory that perhaps the plane turned back or attempted to turn back?
It does seem to, yes. I mean, it's hard for me, or for any of us really, to believe that a plane could turn around, fly across the Malaysian Peninsula on what must be pretty busy airspace, and then, you know, crash into the sea on the other side of the landmass. But you know, you just don't know. I mean, you don't know what they know and what they're not telling us. For example, they did say that there was a sign the plane might have turned around before disappearing, but it would have to be a pretty catastrophic failure of Malaysia's own radar systems for them not to have noticed that a jet airliner flew right across their landmass without them noticing.
It's elements of this baffling situation that have civil aviation experts scratching their head. Can you just remind us of some of the other aspects of this case that have people so confused?
There's people coming on with stolen passports, of course. That's one of the things which has people baffled. But then that could just as easily be a coincidence, and we really don't know that's connected. It turns out, something we didn't know, that it's quite common for people to fly with stolen passports across Asia. And actually, Interpol have a huge database of stolen passports, 39 million of them. But immigration officials almost never bother to check against that database. That's something I didn't know, but doesn't make me particularly confident about flying across the region. Really, pretty much anything's up for grabs. I mean, Chinese relatives of the people on board the plane claim that they phoned, they actually got through to mobile phones of their relatives after the plane had disappeared, and the phones rang. Presumably that's a telecom, some kind of telecoms glitch or some kind of telecoms fault. But in the state we're in now, where nobody knows anything, it's not surprising those relatives were sort of clinging to that straw and actually quite angry yesterday and today that the authorities didn't appear to have taken them very seriously.
Simon, you're in Beijing for the Washington Post. Can you explain what the response has been from Chinese officials? Because they've most recently, it seems, they're asking Malaysia to intensify the search efforts, right?
The initial kind of mood that was coming out of all of the Asian countries was we're all in this together, but that's kind of given way a little bit, to be honest. The Chinese have starting to sound increasingly peeved at the Malaysians for not having found the plane. They're under pressure themselves, of course. I mean, the relatives are pretty angry with everybody. They were throwing water bottles at Malaysian airline officials both yesterday and today. But they were also shouting and screaming at the Chinese officials for not having done more, for not having visited them before, for not having given them more information. So the Chinese government feels under a certain amount of pressure with, you know, a large percentage of the passengers on the board the plane coming from China. They feel under pressure. They're transferring some of that pressure to Malaysia and sounding a little bit frustrated with the Malaysians.
Simon Drainer in Beijing. The case of Malaysia Flight 370 has aviators and investigators baffled and has given rise to a number of theories ranging from structural failure to terrorism. To try and get a better understanding of what potentially could have occurred, I spoke to David Learmount, an aviation security specialist and operations director for Flight International magazine.
This case is not unique. The extreme cases are cases like a British Lancastrian aircraft not long after the Second World War going missing in the Andes, and its wreckage was only found in the last few years. We can relate this just to an event in 2009 when an Air France Airbus A330 went missing over the South Atlantic. There was also, in that case, no radio call. It also happened very, very early in the morning when pilots are at their lowest performance level. Something happened suddenly, and in the case of the Air France people, the pilots really rather lost the plot. Just because the circumstances of the disappearance look similar, it does not mean that the cause of the Malaysian is the same as the cause of the Air France 447.
Is the technology good enough? Is it up to date? Is the black box as reliable as it should be?
Let's go back in history to 2009 again and have a look at what happened with the black boxes for the Air France flight. It took several days to find wreckage floating on the surface, but they eventually did find some. But then it took 2 years, because it was in a very deep part of the Atlantic, they took 2 years to recover the wreckage or to find the wreckage on the bottom of the sea. But when they did, they recovered the two flight recorders, and they worked. Despite being more than 4,000 meters under the sea for 2 years, they worked. So, you know, whatever happens here, the sea is not as deep if the aircraft came down where we think it did in the South China Sea. It's nothing like as deep. So shouldn't take so long to find the flight data recorders, and so we have a good chance of finding out what happened here.
David, with your experience, can you understand why the pilots were unable to communicate a problem?
If something had gone really wrong, the pilots are going to be extremely preoccupied with sorting it out. Okay, so they've got to save their own lives as well as the lives of the passengers and the crew on board. So they'll be extremely preoccupied. However, it's usually pretty important for them, and they know this, to get a message that they are in trouble to air traffic control. In this case, they didn't do it. And in the Air France 447 case in 2009 over the South Atlantic, they didn't do it either, because in the latter case, they became very preoccupied, very fixated, very quickly on a problem. And interestingly enough, it was that fixation which led them to get so confused about the state of the airplane in this very dark, inky night that they didn't know which way up the airplane was, and they lost control of it completely. Now, as I say, you can't, although the circumstances of the disappearance in both cases was remarkably similar, we cannot read into this that the cause of the loss of the aircraft was, crew confusion.
While the case of this missing flight certainly has experts, aviation experts like yourselves, confused as to the circumstances and chain of events, it also has passengers, people who have flown and certainly intend to continue flying with commercial airlines, concerned for their safety. Is that warranted?
Events like this involving a very big passenger jet, one of the latest generation ones, these are incredibly rare now. Just to give you an idea of the simple statistics, last year there were no accidents involving big jets. In the world, there were no accidents involving passenger carrying big jets. In most years, there are no accidents involving these. The number of people killed in all kinds of accidents relating to airlines, even tiny little ones which were operating, more or less air taxi type services around the world, there were only 26 of them worldwide, including those tiny ones and including freight alone carriers, and only about 200 people died worldwide, globally. And there were 3 billion passenger journeys. If you work out your chances, you could fly every day for 50 lifetimes and not be in a fatal accident.
David Learmount, an aviation security specialist and operations director for Flight International magazine. This is FSN Reports. British Prime Minister David Cameron says Western powers should be willing to throw Russia out of the G8 if there's no progress creating a contact group to hold talks over Ukraine. Speaking in the British Parliament, Mr. Cameron said a failure to advance negotiations could lead to the recreation of the G7, which was expanded to include Russia back in 1998. Mr. Cameron also said the proposed referendum later this month on whether the Crimean Peninsula should become part of Russia is illegal.
Any campaign would actually be completely impractical as well as illegal. There is no proper register, no proper campaign. The territory is covered with troops. It's completely impossible for a proper referendum campaign to be carried out.
But there is no indication that the referendum slated for March 16th won't take place. Indeed, the Crimean Parliament released a copy of the ballot paper today that will be used in the vote. So, what should the United States do next? FSN's Simon Mark spoke to David Kramer, the president of Freedom House and a former Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights and Labour.
I would argue that step, expelling Russia from the G8, should have already happened. We need to move beyond expelling Russia from the G8. It is time for economic sanctions, financial measures, going after Russian individuals and state-owned enterprises. The situation in Ukraine caused by Mr. Putin's decision to send forces in is accelerating, escalating. It's not calming down.
You said things are accelerating. The Polish foreign minister said today the timetable for the Kremlin's annexation of the region is accelerating daily. Are you saying that when you look at events on the ground there, you don't see any evidence that Vladimir Putin is backing down?
It seems that more Russian forces are going into Crimea, that the referendum is bearing down. It's now less than a week away, and that is not going to help the situation. And there seem to be more exercises conducted by Russian forces. So Mr. Putin is showing, I think, considerable defiance in the face of the, not just Western, but international reaction to Russia's violation of Ukraine's sovereignty, territorial integrity. And it does seem to me that the situation is getting more tense by the day.
Would economic sanctions force him to back down? They certainly wouldn't work quickly.
They wouldn't work quickly, but given Russians' exposure to the West, to Europe, even less so to the United States, but still to the United States, the Kremlin circle, like to keep their assets overseas. They don't feel that it's safe and secure to keep their assets inside Russia, so they buy real estate, they buy other property, they invest, they stow away their, in some cases, ill-gotten gains in Western financial institutions. And so if Europe and the United States really to go after these assets, I think it would cause significant repercussions inside Moscow and even inside the Kremlin. And so I think it is a step very much worth taking.
But there is a big if there, isn't there? Because while they like to keep their ill-gotten gains, as you put it, overseas, many of the governments of those overseas nations quite like having that money sloshing through their capitals. So what do you do if you can't bring Germany and Britain, for example, on board for a tight array of sanctions?
It's unfortunate that it's taken this crisis for an examination of the kind of money that is in these countries, in the UK and Germany, frankly, in the United States. But now, in light of the situation in Ukraine, this is not a time for business as usual. This is not a time to put the trade dollars and investment that countries may have in Russia ahead of what is a naked aggression against a neighboring state.
At the end of the day, though, if you're not willing to exercise any kind of military option, and neither the administration in Washington nor those in Berlin or London seem to be flirting with any kind of military option, can anything be done short-term to concentrate Vladimir Putin's mind and stop him, in essence, from annexing the Crimean Peninsula?
Boosting the defense and security of NATO allies is something that does appear to be in the works, with more fighter planes from the U.S. going to the Baltic states. The U.S. is actually in charge of the air policing operation for this quarter with the Baltic states, beefing up Poland's security. I think all those steps are and can and should be taken. It's a tricky issue. There's no doubt about it. But let's remember that John Kerry, when he went out on the Sunday talk shows now 8 days ago, made it clear that all options are on the table, and that's, to me, the best way to approach this.
After this is over, assuming we get to the after this is over, will it ever be business as usual again between the Obama administration and the Kremlin, or is it good for it not to be business as usual again?
I don't see how it can be business as usual again as long as Mr. Putin is in the Kremlin. And what this gets at is that the nature of regimes matters. It has an impact, obviously, on the human rights of people inside Russia, but it also projects into Russia's foreign policy. We see it in Putin's support for the murderous Assad regime in Syria. We see it now in the case of Ukraine, but we've seen it with pressure on Armenia to not initial the Eastern Partnership Agreement last September, on Moldova and Georgia, of course, 2008 with Georgia. It goes on and on. So it does get at the root of the problem, which is the nature of the Putin regime. It is a nasty authoritarian regime that shows no respect for human rights. And the irony is Putin likes to say he's coming to the defense of ethnic Russians in Ukraine. Well, he doesn't give a damn about Russians inside his own country. So he only uses this for political purposes when it's expedient for his purposes.
FSN Simon Marks talking to David Kramer, President of Freedom House and former Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights and Labour. Now, as the US mulls a multi-pronged response to the crisis in Ukraine, many lawmakers, corporations and pundits are calling for President Obama to use US oil and gas as a diplomatic tool. Specifically, they want the Obama administration to expedite plans to liquefy much of our domestic natural gas supply and ship it overseas. But the idea faces pushback from many environmentalists and economists, who say it would take years to build the infrastructure and it could raise gas prices domestically and pollute local communities. In Washington, D.C., Alice Ulstein has more.
The older leadership of the Republican Party and its younger Tea Party-aligned members, two groups usually at odds, have been united over the past few weeks in pushing what they see as a possible solution to the crisis in the Ukraine. As Texas Republican Ted Cruz told FSN, they want the U.S. government to help corporations ship natural gas drilled here overseas to chip away at Russia's current dominance of that market.
The most effective economic blackmail Russia uses against Ukraine is natural gas. We have an abundance of natural gas, and we ought to be exporting liquid natural gas to Ukraine. That would both benefit us here at home. It would generate jobs and economic growth, and at the same time, it would help liberate Ukraine from the economic blackmail of Russia.
Russia not only supplies the majority of gas to the Ukraine, it controls a vast network of pipelines that transport the gas to many European countries. Speaking on Fox News on Sunday, Kentucky Republican Rand Paul said the U.S. should attempt to substitute that flow.
Because that would immediately get every obstacle out of the way for our export of oil and gas. And I would begin drilling in every possible and conceivable place within our territories in order to have production that we could supply Europe with if it's interrupted from Ukraine.
But many economists and energy experts say it's not that simple. While there has been a boom in natural gas drilling in the United States over the past few years, with significant government support, there are currently no facilities prepared to turn that gas into liquid and transport it, and no facilities in the Ukraine ready to receive it. The Department of Energy has approved a handful of export facilities around the U.S., on Texas's Gulf Coast, and on both the West and East Coasts, but none will be ready until at least late 2015, if not years later. That's why energy policy analysts like Peter Ogden with the Center for American Progress say this current push for exports can't help the situation in the Ukraine right now, but it could have a negative impact on U.S. residents.
Right now, the United States, particularly manufacturing sectors, are benefiting from low natural gas prices. And of course, if you start to export, then they're going to foresee that there will be some rise in domestic prices.
Local groups that live near some of the proposed natural gas export terminals and drilling sites are also raising concerns. Maryland communities close to the site of the proposed Cove Point natural gas export terminal have been protesting over the past few months, and several were arrested in February for civil disobedience at the county courthouses currently debating the permits for the project. Maryland resident Mike Tidwell with the Chesapeake Climate Action Network described some of his concerns about the export facility, which would be run by the company Dominion Power.
There can be vapor cloud leaks. There can be liquefied natural gas spills. There could be these different processes involve combustion that could ignite a vapor cloud. So this part of Southern Calvert County in Maryland, you do have the bay shore right there. You do have wetlands that have been preserved. You do have forests to the north of the plant and a state park. But to the south and to the east of this proposed plant, you actually have human communities. You have neighborhoods of hundreds and hundreds of houses that are exceptionally close to the facility. So we believe it's just inappropriate and dangerous and scary what Dominion is proposing.
Tidwell said it was ridiculous for politicians to say natural gas exports could help the Ukraine right now, pointing out that it's an effort that was in the works long before the current crisis in that part of the world. Dominion Power has spent hundreds of thousands of dollars lobbying Congress and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission over the past few years, on top of donating hundreds of thousands of dollars to both Democrats and Republicans. Companies are also joining under the umbrella of groups like the American Natural Gas Alliance, which spent nearly $2 million on lobbying in 2013 alone. Ogden at the Center for American Progress and other analysts also question whether U.S. companies would agree to sell their gas to the Ukraine or Europe at a price competitive with Russia's subsidized supply, when they could get a much higher price selling it to Asian markets. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
And that's the Monday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the program by emailing us, reports@featurestory.com, and you can get in touch with us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. Coming up on Tuesday, find out why the gender gap is closing fast in the emerging tech industry. That's Tuesday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.